I'm going to be playing with the Early Roman Kings, a Dylan tribute show at Joe's Pub in New York City on July 23rd. And right now I'm here with Rabbi Saul Solomon and this wonderful show, Dave Gone By, on fabulous UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, shalom, my friends. This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon, founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And you know, I often talk to people who are celebrities, who are writers, who are actors, but I do love musicians as well. And we have an amazing, masterful musician to talk to today. Now think about this. When we think of banjo music, we think of Americana and hoedowns and hootenannies and Ned Beatty getting raped. But there's more to it, so much more. And we have Tony Trischka on the show with us. He's got bunches of albums. His music, I know I talked about the theater. You could have heard it in The Robber Bridegroom on Broadway, Driving Miss Daisy off Broadway. He's a Grammy nominee, and he's played with the likes of Steve Martin, Bela Fleck, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, The Violent Femmes, Earl Scruggs, and the list goes on. But enough listing. Let's do some talking and listening to Tony Trischka. Welcome to the neighborhood. Shalom!
Shalom, and thank you, Rabbi. It's a great pleasure to be here with you.
Oh, and likewise, too. Let me ask you about the banjo. Is it, because you teach banjo, and we're going to talk a lot about that, is it much harder to learn and master than the guitar?
I think it's easier to start with the banjo because it's an open tuning. You strum it, at least when you're playing bluegrass music, you strum it, and you're already playing a good chord. You don't even have to use your left hand, so in that sense, it's easier. But, you know, if you want to master any instrument, they're all tricky, I guess, in a sense. But I think it's maybe a little bit easier to get started with the banjo because of that open tuning.
Huh, I did not think of that. You've been doing this for quite a few years. Have there been waves of interest in learning and hearing the banjo? Does it peak and valley? And maybe since Steve Martin got really into it, it's kind of gone a little more up? Or has it been sort of a flat? You know what I'm asking. I think you know what I'm asking. I don't.
I know. Yeah, there have been a number of big bangs. You know, the first one was probably Foggy Mountain Breakdown, the theme from Bonnie and Clyde, where it, you know, really took off for a little while, whenever that was, mid to later 60s, whatever. Actually, before that, there were the Beverly Hillbillies, which turned a lot of people onto the banjo, including the illustrious Bela Fleck. That TV show in the early to mid-60s.
Oh, and Hee-Haw. How can we forget Hee-Haw? That's right.
Let's not forget Hee-Haw. That must have had some sort of a hand in it. And then you mentioned Ned Beatty and that unfortunate incident, but reflecting on dueling banjos from the Deliverance film, and that really reached a lot of people. And then I think it was just kind of cruising along, but now that Steve Martin has been really getting into the banjo, I mean, he's played it since high school, but since he's been really doing it on a more regular basis with a great band called I'm already forgetting their name. This is very embarrassing. But anyway, Steve Canyon Rangers, thank you. So he's doing that. So he's reaching a lot of people with a banjo because of his celebrity, of course. So yeah, it's kind of cruising along pretty well right now, I think.
Now, we've already mentioned two of the better-known people who pick up and play the banjo. Can you, you know, there are people who, if they listen to a guitar, even an acoustic guitar, they can tell, oh, it's Neil Young playing that versus another artist playing the guitar versus somebody else. Can you do that? Could you tell a Steve Martin lick on the banjo from a Bela Fleck or somebody else?
I mean, I can tell, sure. You know, I'm not sure if everyone, if someone listened to Steve Martin playing for 1 minute and Bela Fleck playing for a minute, you could probably, the average person could probably tell if they had a sense of, you know, how Steve Martin played, yeah. Because they have very different styles.
Well, explain, like, what is your style that would differentiate you from Flat and Scruggs, let's say?
Okay, well, let's see. Earl Scruggs is still my favorite banjo player, and I think he's the greatest banjo player who ever lived and ever will live. No matter where it goes, it always comes back to Earl for this kind of playing that we do, this picking. Having said that, I learned so much from him and continue to this day. I still work on his solos and learn new things from him. But there are other great players that I won't get into because it would get too technical, but who have moved the banjo forward, and I think we all just learn from the people that came before us. So I learned from, well, there's a guy named Bill Keith who developed something called the melodic style, which allowed you to play single melody notes. And another guy named Don Reno, who also did it in a different way. The same idea where you could play, those are the three innovators, Reno, Keith, and Scruggs. And so I learned from all three of those gentlemen, and then just sort of added stuff, because I didn't grow up down south listening to bluegrass music. My father was a physics professor, and my mother was went to Columbia University, and I grew up in Syracuse, New York, and I had a whole different background. But I fell in love with this music, but I also was really, you know, grew up in the 60s and was really influenced by Van Dyke Parks and the Beach Boys and Dylan and Miles Davis and the Beatles, of course, and on and on. And so I have all these influences in classical music. So my music came through that prism. So I kind of came up with my own style in certain ways that was different and just stretched the boundaries a little bit for myself.
Well, without being too technical, in other words, aside from deciding to play more jazzy songs and things like that, do your fingers move differently? Is it faster, slower? Is there a little a trick, a lick, a thing that your fingers do?
It's not faster, that's for sure. You listen to Earl Scruggs play Foggy Man Breakdown in 1951. It doesn't get a whole lot faster than that. It's, your left hand will go to different positions, let's say, than Earl would have gone to. Your right hand might do something a little different, although everything I do in certain ways is influenced by Earl. But both hands would move in slightly different ways. Yeah, I would say that's accurate.
You have a banjo school. I mean, you used to give tutorials in person, and then you used to do it by tape back and forth. Now I assume everything is online, digital files coming back. But you've done about 200 banjo lessons. You know, these little instructional tapes and things. And I have to wonder, what the hell is there to teach after, say, 138? What have you,
It's kind of the limit. Everything else is just dross after that.
Yeah, I mean, do you get to 177 and say, oh, I don't know.
Why go beyond 138? That's funny you should mention that number. That's exactly, everything else is just chaff. Well, I mean, it's an infinite journey, as it is with any instrument. You can go forever just going deeper and deeper and deeper and fancier and fancier and fancier or whatever. More soulful playing. You know, the longer you play, hopefully you get more soulful with it. Hmm. But, I've got this online banjo school through a company called ArtistWorks, and I've been doing it for just about 8 years now. And it's a subscription-based thing, and I've got, at this point, actually probably closer to at least 225, 250 lessons pre-recorded. And the concept was to have lessons that are maybe 5 to 8 minutes long, rather than buying a book and having, okay, I've got to get through this, you know, 172-page book, or to get a 90-minute DVD, back when people used to do DVDs, even though I've got books and DVDs out. But it's, you got this big thing you got to deal with, and the ArtistWorks concept is, okay, here's one lesson that's 5 to 8 minutes long, and then you go through that lesson, and you conquer that technique or that song, and then you move on to the next one. So you're getting these little bits of it, and you have a sense of accomplishment a bit along the way. And it starts like, here's how you hold the banjo, and then it ends up past the lesson 138, I think you mentioned, but, you know, up in the 200s, you're learning Bela Fleck tunes and some really high-end graduate-level stuff. Plus, I've got about 45 interviews now with Bela Fleck and Steve Martin and J.D. Crowe, just people that not everyone would know. But there's an interview with Earl Scruggs on there. So almost all of them, with a couple of exceptions, are all video. These other people give tips. And kind of the most important thing is people can send in a video also. It's not Skype, but it goes into a queue. And then within a day or two, or sometimes a week if I'm on the road, maybe a little longer, but around that time, I'll respond to it and then critique folks in a gentle, friendly manner.
Okay. With 200 or 225 people subscribing, how much of your life and how much of your week does it take up, not just to watch their videos, but then to have to do a video answer to them?
Well, I don't have a life. That's the point.
Welcome to my world. Yes.
Only a very small number of people, of the total number of people that are on the site, maybe 5% send in videos. Otherwise, it would be, you know, unworkable. But it just turns out that people are shy and they would just rather go through the lessons and not feel exposed to everyone, because it's something that everyone, we call them video exchanges, and everyone on the site can view these. They go up, and it's nice. It kind of spotlights people, but you have to be willing to make a mistake and let people see that. And but it's really helpful when people do send in a video exchange, because I can say, okay, here, you're not hitting the first string loud enough, or your timing needs work, or whatever it is. And it's pretty easy to identify things pretty quickly and help people forward.
Now, there's also an element of showmanship in musicianry. Have you ever smashed a banjo, like on stage, like a Pete Townsend sort of a thing, or just in anger, or...
No, I've thought of it. I remember when I was probably 14, maybe 15, being really frustrated with the banjo, really angry. I was home, and I remember holding it out at arm's standing and holding it at arm's length in the case and letting it drop. And it didn't break, and that's as much as I did. That's as close as I came to doing that out of anger, but fortunately it didn't break.
And also, in one of your private moments, if not on stage, did you ever try to do some of the flashy Hendrix-y above the head, play with your tongue, that sort of thing?
I think I tried it with the tongue one time. It's funny, no one's ever asked me that question. I think I tried it with the tongue once when I saw, realized that Hendrix did that. Like, I could do that. But the banjo is so heavy, it's sort of hard to hold up there for very long. There have been moments when I wanted to ignite it with lighter fluid and put a match to it, but again, I wasn't at Monterey myself, and it would have felt like I was just copying Hendrix, so I passed.
Yeah, the smoke would have come up, and it would have just brought up the spirits of the Confederacy, really, if you think about it. Just kidding. Well, that is another question about the banjo. Only you could answer this question. Has a banjo ever been used in classical music?
Oh, definitely.
Really?
Going way back into the, right around, I don't know, it actually started in the 1870s and through like the 1910s or something like that, they would play light classical music on a banjo.
I never...
It was all written out for banjo, yeah. And then various people, a guy named Bill Keith, did some Bach on the banjo, and I've done Bach on the banjo. I worked up a couple of the two-part inventions. I worked up a Beethoven mandolin sonata, and Bela Fleck has written two concertos for banjo and orchestra.
An orchestra? Whoa!
So I've done it with the Philadelphia Orchestra and the Denver Symphony, and then travels around.
Because it's interesting. I can imagine certainly a sonata or a minuet or a little thing with one or two instruments together, but to actually concoct a classical sounding piece where the banjo is an element, if not the lead element, I would figure the sound wouldn't fit, but I guess like guitar it can.
Yeah, well that's the thing. People stereotype the banjo, less so these days, but stereotype it as well. It's that hillbilly instrument or bluegrass instrument, and it's a musical instrument. People have to get used to the idea that, you can do anything with it. It's just been so stereotyped for so many years because of all the things that made it more popular, like dueling banjos and Beverly Hillbillies and Foggy Mountain Breakdown and all that. Bonnie and Clyde, it's, car chases and
cousins of course, marrying and things like
North,
that.
North Georgia, and the image is, bales of hay and hillbillies, like I say. It's because all the things that made it really popular helped to reinforce that stereotype. But in fact, it does all this other stuff.
Well, did it also come from this African kind of instrument called, what is it, a banza? Something like that?
Yes, absolutely. You know your banjo.
Well, no, I've just been looking over your bio, so I figured I'd throw that in there.
Yeah, but you've educated yourself.
A little bit. So tell us about the banza. You even play it on a couple of songs here and there on your album. So tell us about the banza and how that evolved into the banjo.
Well, the banjo comes originally from Africa, and when enslaved Africans are brought to the Americas, in some cases, there's one incident that I found in, I guess, the 1700s in Jamaica where slave ships was, they would have the enslaved African play the instrument on the boat and bring the other enslaved Africans on to the, up on top to exercise them. They would have to dance or they would be whipped with the cat of nine tails. And this would help them to survive that middle passage so that they could be sold when they came to the Americas.
What a lovely story. story, yes.
But then on Caribbean shores and North American shores, they would recreate these instruments with a gourd and a rough-hewn neck, and then sometimes horse's hair twined together with beeswax to make strings. And it was a part of plantation life, and which is one reason why African Americans frown on the banjo, because of its what it's associated with. But I did an interview with Taj Mahal some years ago, and he felt like, well, this is the reality, and Taj Mahal plays banjo. And, you know, he said, rather than looking the other way, you've got to accept that it's part of what happened.
I mean, it's tough for even American blacks to go there, because the minstrel shows and Aggie Cantor and the blackface, I don't know if Al Jolson played one, but those kinds of entertainers also played the banjo all corked up. You know, Banjo Eyes was actually one of Cantor's... God, I sound like Joe Franklin now, but you know what I'm saying.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's the other thing, besides just the enslaved aspect of it, but just the minstrel shows, which at first there was a genuine interest. There was a guy named Joel Walker Sweeney, who's supposedly the first white to play the banjo. Now, it's hard to know if that's totally accurate, but he started one of the very first minstrel shows, and he grew up in Appomattox, Virginia, and there were enslaved Africans right there, and he loved their music and their songs and their dances, and he adapted all that. At least initially, it was a love for that, and there was, I think, a certain fascination up north, you know, these kind of traditions that were down south. It was so exotic up there, and of course, there was slavery in the north, too, and all over the north, in New England, which was, you know, for so many years, people felt, well, it was all down south, but that's not the case at all. There was a northern plague also.
But I assume your audiences, even now, are probably like 95%, you know, old white people. Well, or young people, too.
If not 100%. Yeah, which is unfortunate, because it can be music for everyone, but it doesn't try to draw that kind of a crowd. And my wife used to do a show, concert series, here in Fairlawn, New Jersey, where I live. We got Pete Seeger come and do a show, and he specifically said, I don't want an all-white audience, please, if you can find a more diverse audience. And my wife happened to work in Teaneck, New Jersey, and worked in a school that was certainly had a strongly black population, and got some people to come so it would not be an all-white audience, because this kind of music tends to attract that kind of an audience, and it's unfortunate that it can't be more diverse, but that's the reality.
Actually, I have a question. I mean, you're a well-known musician, Grammy-nominated, you've got all these subscribers and stuff, you've sold albums, and yet you choose to live in New Jersey. What, have your hat examined? I'm kidding. But why New Jersey?
Well, I grew up in Syracuse, New York, moved to New York City because some great musicians invited me to sit to play with their band, start a band with them. That was in 1973, and I just ended up in New York City, living there until 1989. You know, I once talked to John Hartford, and he said, you should move to Nashville. That's where your people are and your music is. But Bela Fleck lived in Nashville, and you really don't need another banjo player there. So, I don't know.
If you don't need another banjo player in Nashville, there's no other place you're going to need more banjo players. With all due respect.
I mean, they fall from the trees there, so... Oh. It seemed like, you know, I can have a better shot at getting work up here. And it wasn't even that conscious a thing. It was just I was comfortable here. My friends were here. Yeah. And my family was in Syracuse, close by. And I just felt more comfortable in the Northeast. So I just stayed here. And then when I met my wife, we ended up moving out to New Jersey. And we're very close to New York City, so we can get into the city within either 20 minutes or 3 hours, depending on traffic.
And hey, and let's not leave out the fact that New Jersey has some very nice beaches. You're not allowed on them, but you can go to this little political joke there.
You can go down the shore, as we say in New Jersey. You don't go to the beach. You go down the shore.
We're going up the down staircase and down the shore here with Tony Trischka, the master musician here on the Dave's Gone By radio program of the air. Let's talk about some people that you've worked with, you've played with, that you know. I want to especially know about this fella named Noam Pekelny, because he's a Jew. Can you tell that he's Jewish from the way he plays?
No, not really. Although it's interesting, there was this northern bluegrass
glass, I guess you would call it.
Yes.
He brew glass.
Something like that. And then old-time music also. Hank Sapoznik, Bob Carlin, you know, I could go down, Steve Arkin. I mean, there are all sorts of folks. Mark Horowitz, I mean, all these people that are from the New York area that were attracted to this music.
Folks that you have interviewed and talked with and, of course, played with, any great anecdotes or other memories about Pete Seeger besides the, you know, the white and black thing?
Yeah, well, yeah, a number of stories, one of which I was at the Vancouver, I think it was actually the Winnipeg Folk Festival, this big folk festival up in Canada, and I had to go back to the airport, and they had this school bus ferrying people back and forth, so I get on the bus to go back to the airport to head back to the States, and I get on the bus, and besides the bus driver, there's only one other passenger, and it was Pete Seeger, and he's sitting in the front seat by the driver, and so I sat right down behind him, and, hey, Pete, how you doing? And he said, you know, Tony, the problem was audiences these days, they don't know how to sing the bass part. And I said, yeah, okay. He said, do you know how to sing Down by the Riverside? And I said, sure, Pete, I grew up listening to you sing that on the record. And he said, well, why don't you sing that, and I'll show you what I mean. So I started singing, gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside. And suddenly Pete's singing along with me going, lay down my sword and shield. And he started singing this bass part. And so here I am doing a sing-along with Pete, just the two of us, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then we get to the airport, and there are these long lines waiting to go through customs, like 7 or 8 really long lines. Most people in business use, you know, heading to the States on business. And here we are, these two folky, bluegrassy, jean-clad, boot-wearing, you know, slightly scruffy people. And I'm in one line, and Pete's next to me in the line next to me. We're talking and just kind of zoning out a little bit, and then I look over and Pete gets down on his hands and knees, and opens up his banjo case in front of hundreds of people trying to get into the States, just kind of frustrated by the lines not moving. Takes out the banjo and just starts playing. I figure, well, if Pete can do it, I can do it. So I got out my banjo and started playing banjo duets in line at Canadian, well, you know, U.S. Customs in Canada. And, you know, you see people kind of casting sidelong glances, like, who are these weirdos? It's Pete Seeger, for gosh sake.
Oh, I'm sure some recognized him instantly.
Yeah, probably a few here and there, but yeah. So that's one of my...
That's a great...
That's one of my fondest memories.
I can imagine. So give me more anecdotes like that about other people that you've played with, that you've known, whether they're banjo people or people more far-flung in pop and rock and folk culture and country culture.
Let's see. I produced Steve Martin's second album, which is called Rare Bird Alert, second album of the recent era.
That's a really nice album, by the way. Yes.
Yeah, wonderful album from 6 years ago, whatever it is now. You know, it was going to be with the Steep Canyon Rangers, but he had one or two songs he wanted to get some other folks on there, and he had this kind of silly love song that he had written, you know, lyrics, and he wanted to have someone sing it, and he had a couple of ideas, but he wasn't really sure, but he was going to go with those, and I was talking to my son about it, and it was, you know, I said, yeah, Steve wrote this silly love song, and here's who we were thinking of having on it. My son said, well, why not get Paul McCartney to sing it? And I go, oh, yeah, right, we're going to get Paul McCartney, and I said, well, it is Steve Martin, so I mentioned to Steve that my son had suggested that. Steve said, well, there's an interesting idea. And he made it happen. He got Paul McCartney to sing on his album. And so we were recording in Asheville, North Carolina. And if you say in Asheville, it sounds like you're in Nashville, but in Asheville, North Carolina. But Paul was up in Long Island with his daughter. He had custody of his daughter at this point. And for those few days when we wanted to record, we recorded in this woman's house that had like a little closet that was soundproofed, and we brought our engineer up, and lo and behold, we got Paul McCartney to sing on his album. And since I was producing, technically I got to produce Paul McCartney's vocal, which is when Sgt. Pepper came out, that was such a big moment in my life. And if someone said someday you're going to produce Paul McCartney's vocal, yeah, right.
Well, wait a minute. But again, did you fly up to Long Island to be in the closet where Paul McCartney was? Or was it by Skype in Asheville or something like that?
No. This was when we flew up there.
Oh, you flew to Long Island. Yeah.
Yeah, we all flew up there in Steve's jet, which is a nice way to travel. Paul walks in the door, and it's Paul friggin' McCartney. And he was just, should we call him Sir Paul? But he was just very, put everyone at their ease, joking around, and made everything really comfortable, and he was just a guy.
Was it the first time Steve Martin had met him in person, or had they run into each other before?
They'd run into each other at Saturday Night Live one time. But my favorite part of this was, we given him a glass of water when he went in to start singing. He sang for about 45 minutes. He was doing amazing stuff, improvising and doing really cool stuff. And then after about 45 minutes, he came out, and I said, would you like to rehydrate, you know, to have some more water? And he said, and I'm like standing 2 feet, you know, right in front of him. And he said, would Elvis Presley sing? And then Paul McCartney starts singing, you ain't nothing but a hound dog, you're rocking all the time. Excuse me, can I have a glass of water? And then he said, or, you know, if it was the Beatles and we were singing, she loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. Can I have a glass of water? So here I am standing in front of Paul McCartney singing those two lines of She Loves You. And, you know, and I've been around the block a few times, and it's not like, you know, like I'm totally wowed by celebrity or anything. Because, you know, hanging out with Steve, that's a pretty big celebrity. But, you know, I've met a bunch of people over the years. But still, inside of me, freaking Paul McCartney is singing She Loves You right now. It's like, it's too much. So it was, one of those peak life experiences.
I believe it.
Yeah.
Any other major idols of yours, or just people where the rest of us would go, oh, my, you were working, you were playing with that person, you were talking with so-and-so, anybody else where our jaws would drop?
Nothing like Paul. I mean, that's a bit, okay. You know, that's pretty big. And, you know, of course, working with Steve Martin, he was just a great, generous, amazing guy. When Steve started doing these banjo albums, there's a company called Homespun Tapes that, you know, I used to do some videos for, and they'll do some books of tablature, like banjo tablature, and I suggested to Steve, because Steve always likes to do as much as he can with any project, I said, why don't you put out a book of tablature for this album, the banjo tablature? And so I got in touch with Homespun Tapes, and they said, delay, of course, we'll do it. And so I was working with Steve, got together with him, and he'd play the tunes, and I'd write them down. I was his scribe. And at this one point, he said, well, I'm doing this movie called It's Complicated. I'm going to be out in Queens, New York, filming. And if you want to come out there, you know, there's a lot of downtime between scenes, so we can work on the banjo stuff. And so I found his trailer, went out there, found his trailer. And, you know, we're doing banjo stuff for 45 minutes or whatever. And finally somebody, one of the gophers, comes knocking on the door and says, hey, it's time for your next scene. So Steve says, why don't you come along with me? So we went to where they're shooting the film in this indoor kind of cavernous studio. And he introduced me to the director and one of the producers. And then Meryl Streep is in this movie, and here's Meryl Streep. So Steve introduces me to Meryl Streep. This is my friend Tony Shrishka. He's a wonderful banjo player, blah, blah, blah. And so Meryl Streep goes to shake my hand, but rather than shake me, looks at the fingertips of my right hand and says, oh, that's the wrong hand, and takes the fingertips of my left hand and looks at them. She was checking out my calluses.
And also, you don't want somebody who's going to, you know, do a Donald Trump handshake on you.
It was a 20-minute Donald Trump handshake, but it's her, and she's like, it's Meryl Streep, and rather than just a pleasant shaking of the hand, she was so cool, she's checking out the calluses.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not as strong as the banjos there on the guitar. Sorry about that. And so she was just very good-natured and fun that she would do that. And then I got to watch the two of them film the scene. It was a nighttime scene where they're sitting in a car, supposedly at night, driving past streetlights, and they have this thing spinning over the car.
being amazing having you on this program. I want to remind everybody, by the way, that Tony Trischke is going to be at Joe's Pub on Lafayette Street in Manhattan. It's connected essentially to the Public Theater. So if you want to see Donald Trump stabbed to death and Julius Caesar, you can walk on over and then hear some wonderful banjo music from Tony Trischke. Find out more about him, by the way, at his website, TonyTrischke.com, and there'll be information, of course, about his online courses and the back and forth of the files that you can send and the videos. Tony Trischke, TrischkeK.com. Trischke, TonyTrischke.com. By the way, is that derivation? Is that German? Is it? What's your nationality? What's your background?
Basically, my great grandfather and before grew up in what is now Bohemia, and actually in the Czech Republic, a town called Liberec, or a city called Liberec, L-I-B-E-R-E-C, in the Bohemian part of the Czech Republic. But when he was somewhere around 1885 or something, he moved from Bohemia to Germany, because in Czech it's T-R-I-S-K-A, in Germany it's T-R-I-S-C-H-K-A. The CH got added in Germany. And then my grandfather grew up in Germany and moved to Arizona, and there you are. So it's a Czech background, but the Germanization added in.
I just want to make sure about one thing. What year did your grandpa move from Germany to America?
That's a really good question. I don't know if I could answer that.
Just checking.
Tough. Early 1900s, I think.
I want to make sure, you know, your grandparents didn't murder my great-grandparents or something like that. I'm kidding.
No. Long gone. Didn't happen.
Tony Trischke, here's a question. You're 68 years old now.
Yep.
Have you lost any flexibility, any dexterity, and then you compensate with soul? Or are your hands what they were in your 30s and 40s?
You know, they feel about the same. I don't feel any, you know, stiffness in the fingers or anything like that. I can still play pretty much as fast as I need to. I don't have, like, if you hear someone who's like 15 years old and all they want to do is play fast, you know, and they're ready to go. And I don't feel that urge to do that like I used to. But I can, you know, if I'm playing at a festival tomorrow in upstate New York and we're going to play some really fast tunes, and I can still do it. So I don't feel like I've really lost anything.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about airports and waiting on lines and things, which you do in your 30s and 40s. It gets more of a pain in the tush when you're 60s and 70s. So you see yourself playing as many concerts and gigs and traveling as much, or cutting that back in a year or two or five?
I'm not cutting back at all. I mean, I actually just went to Cuba for 6 days with my wife, just more on vacation, although we did sit in with a Cuban band for one tune, and that was some travel there, and then I'm driving up to upstate New York tomorrow, and then flying out to Texas back and forth, out to Dallas the next weekend, and then going to Asheville, North Carolina. Yeah, I'm still traveling as much as ever.
Not to get off the topic, though, but what's Cuba like? Are you seeing it changed yet because of the tourism? More hotels, more new restaurant thingies, people buying newer cars, or is it still 1953 everywhere?
It's not 1953 everywhere. We started out at a resort on this peninsula about 2 hours from Havana, just because we were both working so hard, we wanted to just unwind. So we did that, but then we went to Havana, and we stayed in old Havana for 2 days. And, yeah, those cars are all still there, the 56 Chevys and 57 Buicks and all like that. That's still all happening. I mean, I've never been there, not been there before, so I don't have anything to really compare it with. Mm. It's not like it's been McDonald-ized. You know, you don't have Kentucky Fried Chicken. None of that's happened yet. But once I found out that, my wife had wanted to go for a while and hadn't been able to for various circumstances, but once we found out that in 2018 they're supposed to bring in more luxury hotels, it was like, yeah, we better go there while it's still what it's been. And so it's a fascinating thing that people love Americans, and there's music in not every single club, but when you're in old Havana, it's just like you walk two blocks and there's just some incredible band that's just playing, sometimes without microphones, just for background music, and they're
we have had a wonderful time talking with Tony Trischka. He will be at the Public Theater, the Joe's Pub by the Public Theater on July 23rd. Please do go see him. Very last question for you. Can you pick out one or two songs of yours that you played on albums or in concert over the years that are your really, really special to you, like your favorites?
Let's see. I've got one called The Only Way, which is on my first album, The Rest Light, and which is now on a CD called The Early Days. You know, you're getting old when you have an album called The Early Days. And then there's one on my most recent album, Great Big World, which is called Say Goodbye, which I wrote kind of dedicated to Kate McGarrigle. And my son, Sean, plays mandolin on it. And a guy named Michael Dave, this amazing bluegrass singer, sings it. And it's a tune that I wrote both of the tunes. So I'd say those two are, come to mind immediately as two of my favorites.
Well, I am not going to say goodbye to Tony Trischka. I'm going to say shalom to you because you've been so delightful to talk to. We're playing your music, we're listening to you, and we thank you and continued success and wonderful music to you, Tony Trischka.
Thank you, Rabbi Saul. I have to say, I've done many, many interviews, and I would have to say, this is just about my favorite one that I've ever done, and you just asked great questions, and thank you so much.
Gosh, Gewalt, I'm quelling here. That's
I'm quelling talking to you, so...
Well, shalom, and even better health than I wished you before. I wish people to live to 120. You should live to 122, or 138 even. There you go. That's a special number again.
We'll go for 138.
There you go. Shalom to you.